This is a UVic Military Oral History Program interview with retired Sergeant Ed Dixon. This is recorded
on March 31st, 2017.
At the University of Victoria, interviewed by Olivia Lavely. Mr. Dixon, do I have permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
Thank you. Okay, so for the first question, I'd like to ask, in your own words, how would you define public affairs?
How would I define public affairs? that's a tough one. My experience with public affairs, of course, is in the photography side, mm-hmm. in the videographer side of the house, yeah. And recording the information, you know, to be presented to the Canadian public, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm. And I guess public affairs is the recording of the Canadian history, military history. Mm-hmm. That's the way I view it anyways, from my experience with public affairs.
Yeah.
Yeah. The actual documentation of events that took place or take place.
How did you become involved in military public affairs?
When I got involved in photography in the military, my dream job was to work as a public affairs photographer. And as I progressed through the ranks in different jobs within the military, the opportunity arose where I was asked if I wanted to take a position with the public affairs as a photographer. And, of course, I jumped at the chance. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I did it for, I think, 8 years of my career in the regular force, and then another 12 years in the reserve force. It was just a great opportunity and something I always wanted to do and had very fortunate had a chance to do.
Did you have previous experience with photography before?
I had taken it up as a hobby when I first joined the military I was in the infantry for 6 years, and that's when I started to take it up as a hobby. And then I knew that I didn't want to spend a career in the infantry, mm-hmm. and so the opportunity arose that I was able to transfer from the infantry to the photographic trade, mm-hmm. in the military. And from there, I did several different jobs before I finally wound up in the public affairs world.
Mm-hmm.
And I view the best job for military photographers that they're out there.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Did you have to take subsequent training when you were transferred to become a photographic technician? Yeah.
The initial course is in Borden, Ontario, and at the time I took it, it was 7 months long, and then that was followed by another course of 3 months long after that, and that at the end of the second course, you were considered to be a qualified technician.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what were your primary duties as a photographic technician?
When I first got into the trade, my first 5 years, I spent out at an air weapons testing range in Cold Lake, Alberta. And it wasn't really holding a camera. The camera that we operated was a large, what they call a theodolite, and two people sat on it. And you tracked aircraft and weaponry being dropped or fired from aircraft and various technical things. And it was an air weapons testing range just to evaluate different types of weapons, aircraft weapons and rockets and so on. After that, I was transferred onto the base and did 3 years at what they call a base photo section where you did a lot of technical photography, some little bit of public affairs photography, presentations, promotions, portraits, and a lot of that stuff. After my stint there, I got transferred to Ottawa, where I worked in the what they called the studio at that time, where we did a lot of presentation type photography and a lot of portraits. And then after that, that's when I had the opportunity to move out to West Coast or to Victoria and become a public affairs photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I've got to experience a lot of different places and events that happen around the world.
Yeah. So what would you say were your primary duties as a photographic technician?
Primary duties as a photographic technician would have been, as a public affairs photographer, would have been to capture imagery of Canadian Forces personnel doing their job so that it could be either sent back to the Canada or released in Canada, showing what the Canadian military does, either at home or overseas, whether it be domestic ops or foreign ops. And then we get published in various publications or magazines, or of course now it's all released on either Twitter or internet or something like that. Back in the day, of course, it was all film, and everything took a little longer to get out to the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are the most important skills for someone to work as a photographic technician?
I think probably the biggest skill is be able to interact with people, not be intimidated by, especially within the military, of course, there's a rank structure and a hierarchy. And so you have to be able to deal with senior officers and senior members of the military, sometimes with the politicians that are, part of the military system. And the ability to not be intimidated by that sense of power they have or who they are, mm-hmm. And be able to relate to them basically one-on-one or with all respect, of course. Mm-hmm. And, that's probably one of the biggest things. Mm-hmm. Once you can accomplish that, then the technical side of it, you've already accomplished through your training and stuff like that. So the technical side has already been accomplished. The next step, of course, is to be able to relate to people and communicate.
Do you think the military culture impacted how you took the photos?
I think so. As I often tell people, I've been involved with the military for so long, I consider myself institutionalized. and part of your job, of course, is to portray the military in a positive light. Mm-hmm. You're taking pictures of a senior officer talking or speaking or doing something. You don't want to get that typical Donald Trump image that CNN will put out there. You want something that's a little more pleasing to the individual, mm-hmm. and presents that individual in a positive manner as opposed to a gaping mouth or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Do you think that any other photographic technician or yourself had any journalistic education or were ex-journalists?
There's a few people within the trade I know that had gone through various college programs, a two-year photographic college program. A young lady that worked out here for a few years and is now back east, she went through a college program in Montreal. And so when she came into the military, instead of going through that seven-month initial program, she was given credit for her college program. So she only had to take the three-month program afterwards. And I'm sure within that, the college course, I'm sure there was journalist aspects to her schooling. Other people I know that have gone back and taken, they used to run a specialty course at Grant McEwen College in Edmonton, where it was a public affairs photographer's course, and part of that was to teach you some of the journalist side of the house. You weren't expected to become one, but you were expected to become familiar with it. And then there's also sometimes what they call a unit public affairs officer course, where they teach you to do some basic writing and some journalist stuff, what they call hometowner stuff, where you take a picture of an individual who may be at sea for extended deployment, and so you take a picture of them environmentally in their workspace or something like that, where you do up a short little paragraph, you know, leading Seaman Smith, you know, doing this and that, and you send it to his hometown paper, mm-hmm. and they run a picture and a little story on that particular, you know, son from the hometown, mm-hmm. or daughter.
Yeah. So do you think that your photos had a special role in how civilians saw the military?
I think so. I was fortunate enough to have some of my photos published in various national magazines and papers and stuff, and I would hope that they were seen in a positive light. I'm sure the majority of the ones that people that seen them view them in a positive light.
Where were you stationed for your public affairs duties?
My primary station was in Victoria, BC, mm-hmm. And then I would travel from there, depending on what the tasking was. Honduras and Nicaragua was one of the places I went. Of course, the Gulf War, Part One, as they call it. I was over there, and that's when I was working. One of the times I was working with Major Alfred, we were in the Gulf together for that. That was exciting times. Bosnia, I did a tour in Bosnia. I did a tour in Somalia with the Airborne Battle Group there. But my primary home port, as they say in the Navy, was Victoria.
Do you think that the different cultures that you experienced impacted your photos?
I think so, because it impacted me. Mm-hmm. It had an effect on me, so I can't see how it wouldn't affect, mm-hmm. you know, how I viewed things through the lens, basically. I would definitely say it impacted what I seen. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Do you think your past in the infantry impacted how you captured military life in on camera, whereas if someone, another journalist, might have taken it differently?
I think, yeah. Obviously, you know, what we experience in life and what we do in life becomes who we are. I know people I work with now that their background is traditionally Navy, and so how they see things from the Navy perspective is slightly different than with my background in the Army. Mm-hmm. It definitely affects how you view your work and what you're going to, you know, photograph or document, video, whether it be still or video imagery. Once again, it has to, you know, if it doesn't affect or, you know, what you do or who you become. If you're fortunate, you get to experience a number of different, as we say, elements, and then that hopefully makes you a rounder person. Your experience become a little rounder, and so you get to portray different aspects of the military, mm-hmm. With a little broader sense mm-hmm. of knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you mind expanding on your experience in being a team leader for the airborne video security surveillance of Pope John II's visit to Canada?
That was a very, very busy, I think it was only about 10 days, but it was just a hopscotch across the country. There was four teams of three photographers, and each team had a RCMP security officer attached to us. So it was a team of four. Our first stop was Moncton, New Brunswick. It was busy. And then as soon as the Pope had finished his service in Moncton, of course, he was on a plane heading to his next one. And we left there and went to Toronto and got off in Toronto, and the next day we went up to Midland, Ontario, where his, for us, was his next service. But in the meantime, he'd already, between our Moncton one and the Midland one, he'd already done two other services elsewhere. And several of the other, well, the other teams were following them. The funny story to this whole thing was our last stop was Fort Simpson, Northwest Territories. And so after the Midland one, we flew into Winnipeg, and then from Winnipeg went up to Fort Simpson. And because of the weather, the Pope's plane couldn't get in for the service date that he was supposed to come in. And so we were stranded there. And they said, well, don't worry, because when we went to Vancouver instead of coming to where our stop at Fort Simpson, and they said, well, he'll come back there and just do a quick three-hour stop, do a service, and then and our ride out of Fort Simpson was the second HERC aircraft that was coming in. He was on the first one. The second one was the support aircraft, and that was our ride out of there. Well, the second day when he was supposed to coming back in, we had the same weather conditions, and he couldn't get in. So we were stranded there. And our good friend from the RCMP called his buddy in Yellowknife, and the RCMP sent their plane in to pick him up and left us there. So there we were stranded, but we managed to a few phone calls here and there, and they managed to get a commercial plane into Fort Simpson and pick us up, and eventually we got back down to Edmonton and then bused back up to Cold Lake, which was our home base at the time. But it was very busy, but very exciting at the same time. Mm-hmm. So,
would you say that the way you take photographs of public figures would be different? Be different in how you take pictures of people in the military?
The military has a very particular style, mm-hmm. that they want, because of the military uniform, and the medals are always worn on the left chest, so the left portion is always facing the camera to, you know, the individual always is the same pose basically all the time, so there's not a lot of creativity allowed, or you can get a little bit creative, but after time I realized that the best thing you could do, because there's not a lot you can do as far as posing the individual, what you do then is just try to get the most relaxed, pleasant expression of the individual, whoever it happens to be. And I always say, if they're happy with the way they look, then you've done a good job. Because the way they stand and stuff like that is already predetermined by regulations that mm-hmm. we have to follow. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's always pretty much the same thing. It's a left shoulder slightly canted towards the camera with the Canada flag in the background. And, you know, the background's varied over the years. Mm-hmm. You can, after you become familiar with the different bases across the country, you can almost, without even looking at or knowing where the picture comes from, you can tell almost which base it photographed at. Air Force portraits traditionally have an Air Force tartan somewhere in the background. And, of course, the Navy now has gone to where they have the Navy flag with the addition of the Canadian flag in the picture, so you always know it's either Victoria or Halifax where that picture was taken. And different things that are in the picture, you can pretty much tell where it was taken if you've seen a few in the past.
That's interesting. In your brief, you mentioned that you were assigned to the G7 conference in Toronto. Do you mind explaining the purpose of the event?
It was quite a large group, actually. It was several photographers that were taking pictures, myself included. And then there was probably 10 people working the labs. And what it was the military, Department of National Defense, provided lab support to all of the photographers, accredited photographers, as they say, that were part of the G7 conference. So if you work for a local paper or a paper that wasn't based in Toronto, basically, you could take your film into the lab and have it processed and printed in the lab. They set it up in the Toronto Conference Center right downtown. My job was to photograph basically everything that the press, civilian press, was photographing. When they do the what they call the family portrait, towards the end of every conference, you've seen it on TV 1,000 times, I'm sure, where all the leaders come out and they all stand in a row and they're all standing there and everybody's taking pictures of them. That was one of the things I did. And of course, all the arrivals. At that time, Mulroney was the prime minister. And so every time one of the country the leaders would show up, of course, he would greet them at Toronto City Hall. And we would be standing there and take a picture of the greet and, of course, the playing of the national anthem of whatever country showed up and so on. But, it was I got to photograph Margaret Thatcher, President Reagan, Kohl from Germany. Once again, another exciting time and very quick, very busy, long hours, but long hours are part of the job sometimes.
Do you think the photographs, especially since you were able to capture so many world leaders at that event, played a role in how the public's viewed that conference?
I'm not sure about that because everything I photographed, of course, it was, 75 other photographers in the same bleachers that I was on, taking the same picture. You know, Toronto Star, all the national papers were there, and international papers. So, and all that information went out, that day to the rest of the world. And ours were basically to document for the DND history. It got released to our publications that we had at the time. The military, in my years with them, they've gone through several different variations of national publications. We used to have a national magazine that was called the Sentinel. Now we have a national paper that comes out once a week. It's called the Maple Leaf.
Oh, okay.
And this is stuff that those types of pictures would get published in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they went from a monthly magazine to a weekly paper.
So do you think your primary audience were people already in the military or like people who had family members in the military?
That was our primary audience at that time, yes, for sure. And now, of course, with, electronic news and, a lot more is getting out quicker to the public.
You also have mentioned in your brief that you were involved with pilgrimages to Dieppe and Korea. Since these are definitely locations that have military history involved with them, do you find that your photographs of these pilgrimages became more personable for the veterans?
I think, yeah, because each one of those trips was, the Dieppe one. I tell people the story of one particular gentleman I met on that trip, that he joined the army in 1939, right after war was declared, trained for, I think it was a year and a half or something like that. And I was talking to him when we were on the beach in Dieppe, and he said his war lasted 12 minutes. He hit the beach, he was wounded, unconscious, 12 minutes after he hit the beach, and then he spent the rest of the war in a prisoner of war camp.
Wow.
So all, a year and a half of training, and his war lasted 12 minutes. And then I always remember that story because, it just sort of gets to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then he spends the next 3 years, in a prisoner of war camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I also was very fortunate in the sense I got to meet a gentleman named Reverend John Foote, who was a minister.
Mm-hmm.
And he won the Victoria Cross for his participation in that battle. Because he basically, from the legend, is he was on one of the landing craft to go back to England, so he was being rescued.
Mm-hmm.
And he left there so he could go to the beach and attend to the wounded. And he also mm-hmm. spent the rest of his war in the prisoner of war camp.
Wow.
Yeah, so a certain amount of courage to walk off of mm-hmm. a safe vessel home to, you know. But, yeah, and Korea was a bit of a more connection to me because when I joined the Army, I was a member of the PPCLI, Princess Patricia Canadian Infantry, and they fought in a significant battle in Korea at Kapyong, where they received the U.S. presidential citation because it was literally a few hundred Canadians holding off several thousand Chinese. And that allowed the American forces at that time to pull back and reconsolidate and give them time to counter the offensive from the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really an eye-opener because I'd never been to Korea before
mm-hmm.
to see the terrain that they had to fight in at that time. Yeah, it was very enlightening.
Mm-hmm.
And the gentlemen, the veterans that were on that trip were, I won't say considerably younger than the ones that went in Dieppe, but
mm-hmm.
on average probably about 10 years younger.
Right.
So they were a little more mobile and, you know, it was a lot of fun just listening to them talk, and they went through the different areas where they had fought during the Korean conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And we managed to get up to Panmunjom, where so at the peace table. And I was kind of a, and I shouldn't have been, in hindsight, I shouldn't have been surprised, but we went up there, and there's a process that the South Korea and North Korea go through whenever dignitaries come up to the peace hut, which is still there,
mm-hmm.
Where they basically sort of take possession of the building.
Mm-hmm.
And the building is on the actual border. Half mm-hmm. the building's in North Korea, half the building's in South Korea. And the table, if you're sitting on that side of the table, you're in North Korea. If you're sitting on this side of the table, you're in South Korea. And so you get to walk around the table and be in North Korea. And then in the windows on the North Korean side, of course, are the North Korean soldiers
mm-hmm.
looking in at you. And I'm sure the same thing happens when North Korean brings somebody in. There's mm-hmm. South Korean soldiers looking in the window at them.
Do you feel any sort of pressure knowing that our duty of, when you know that your photographs are taking, that you're taking photographs of events that are considered historical?
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you have an extra sense of duty in how you take those or how you display those photographs?
Yeah, thinking back on some of the stuff I've photographed and, you know, things I've photographed, yeah. There's definitely, depending on the event,
mm-hmm.
There's definitely a sense of pressure,
mm-hmm.
Expectation on doing the job and doing the job correctly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the jobs of a military photographer is to, you know, to document when I was in Cold Lake, we unfortunately had a number of airplane crashes.
Mm-hmm.
And as a photographer, you have to go out there and you have to document the recovery process, not only of anybody that was in the plane, but of all the parts and pieces because of the whole investigation process that follows that.
Mm-hmm.
And getting away from that technical side of it, yeah, of the individuals, you know, going into different, you know, scenarios that happened. Yeah, it was, you know, certain expectation, I don't know if you call it pressure or not, but a certain expectation that, you know, you would, once again, you know, be able to portray the CF, the military, in a positive light.
When you were deployed to the regional office in Victoria, did the purpose or role of your photographs change? For example, you mentioned the Commonwealth Games in your brief. So do you feel like your subject matter changed when you came to Victoria?
No, that's the thing. The subject matter never really changes much. With the Commonwealth Games, the military participation in that was a lot more so than the Olympic Games in Vancouver, because a lot of the medal, what do they call them, medal bearers that carry the medals out for the presentation in the Commonwealth Games, a lot of that was had military members carrying the medals out, whereas the Olympic Games in Vancouver, the military participation in that was in the background. You never seen them. It was a lot done before the games, just for security reasons. But during the games themselves, you'd never seen a lot of the military in Vancouver. There was more so for the Commonwealth Games.
So you have traveled extensively throughout your careers. Would you say there is one country or one individual that you think made the most impact on your photography?
Oh, not sure about individuals. I had the opportunity to work with several other military photographers on different assignments that I was sent on. At times I worked alone or with a public affairs photographer or officer, rather. I worked when I went to Bosnia. I was basically attached to the British Army and worked with a British photographer who I got along with quite well. I enjoyed my time with him and the taskings we did there. Events, each of them had their own challenges. I tell people that the hardest, physically, the hardest tour I did was, of course, with Somalia, because it was there's no infrastructure, or there wasn't any infrastructure in that country, and I don't think there's much more now than there was then. So there wasn't a lot to, everything you had to bring with you. Even to the point of bringing your own water into the country and everything else. So there wasn't a lot that you could get or procure, locally. So so that physically was the hardest one. I tell everybody the story. we first got in country, and, of course, we were given 6 liters of water a day. That was your ration of water. And of course, for the first few days, of course, you drank it all because you needed it. And it took me, I think, a week to save up 3 liters of water that I didn't drink. And I had my first shower with 3 liters of water. So that's my claim to fame. I can have a shower with 3 liters of water. And then things got progressively better, of course, when more supplies were coming in on a more regular routine. And eventually water wasn't a big issue. They have a purification system where they're actually able to take the water out of the river there and purify it to the point where you could use it for washing and showering and stuff like that. Nobody really drank. We still relied on bottled water for drinking. But at least you could have a shower once a day, maybe, if you're we're not out in country somewhere.
Did you ever produce information that was intended for the public directly rather than for the news media?
I think most of the stuff I produced was mostly for the public. not so much to for what you would call news media. Everything that we produced in for internal magazines and papers, of course, was available to the public. And every base has what they call a base paper that they, you know, some are weekly, some are biweekly, and everything that is produced and provided to them, of course, is available to the public even more so now because you can see everything online. But no, it's like I did some stuff for Reader's Digest, which is not really a news, but it's a public. Yeah. And I would, you know, saw some other taskings that I had been given was for release to the public, but not actually definitely not a hard news. Maybe soft news, but not hard news. So I think the vast majority of the imagery that I did was for public consumption.
How much were your duties divided between producing your own material and dealing with the news media? Did you have a lot of contact with other journalists outside the
media? At times. At times you would be asked to escort news media, in the especially the in some situations like the Gulf War, where everything was very restricted access. So you would be asked to escort some of the some news media to different areas, whereas because the public affairs officer would be either off doing a brief or something like that, or taking another group to another area for something. And at times you would almost have one, a case in point. There was a gentleman that came over to Somalia, and I spent 2 weeks with him, and the two of us went around on different little things, either within the camp or out doing patrols. With some of the airborne battle group people, so I was basically, escorting him for the 2 weeks he was in country.
How much of an interaction did you have with the local people? You mentioned Somalia and going to the
jungle. Somalia, not so much. In Qatar for in the Gulf War. We would deal with a local lab downtown because we were still shooting film back in those days, and of course everything had to be processed. So we had a fairly good relationship with a local Qatari in his lab downtown. It was always, the social, the cultural thing there. You go downtown, and the first thing he would do, he would send somebody off to get, tea, because you'd always have to have tea before you discussed anything, and you'd, talk about the weather and. And I'm not a tea drinker, but but you go through the process. It's part of the, and it was enjoyable. I enjoyed it. When I was in Cyprus, of course, it was coffee, Turkish coffee, which I enjoyed a lot more. But the Bosnia tour. We interacted with the locals quite a bit because I quite often go out with another group of people over there that were trying to, just trying to get information, I guess, basically from locals about any possible things that were going on locally that would help us do our job. By the time I did my tour in Bosnia, things were fairly stable. There was still, the landmine issue, which is will go on for another probably 10 or 20 years, just trying to clear everything out that was there. But the population itself is doing a lot better than back in the day.
For sure.
Yeah.
So how often would you say that public affairs approaches the news media with a news story or with new photographs that you wanted to release?
How often?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I would say almost every day.
Oh, wow.
You know, when you consider across the country
mm-hmm.
or around the world,
right.
There's something coming out almost every day. Some of it is very regional or very local,
mm-hmm.
and some of it's national. You know, the Kelowna fires.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the, you know, I was there for that.
So do you think that your experience as a photographic technician has impacted how you see the local news even now?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think not only, you know, as a photographic technician, but my experiences through my lifetime basically now has made me more aware
mm-hmm.
of the world
yeah.
As opposed to, you know, living in Northern Ontario. Mm-hmm. Not to say that they're all rednecks back there, but I just feel I'm more aware of the global picture.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. To your previous roles in infantry, do you think that they've impacted how you saw the media?
Saw the media? No. My first 6 years were in the infantry, and I was a young soldier at the time, and so, you know, I was just basically told where to go and when to be there, and I did.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, had I stayed in that role or in the combat arms longer, it might have changed, but
mm-hmm.
Like any young soldier, you're intimidated by the media
mm-hmm.
because you don't want to say the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
So by saying nothing, it's a safe thing. back then, there wasn't a lot of media coverage of the military, at least at my level.
Mm-hmm.
It was and of course, there wasn't 24/7 newscasts mm-hmm. like there is now back mm-hmm. then. Yeah. So.
Do you feel like you had to portray an event or omit certain photographs because of how if the media might have like if the media had a different view of a certain situation? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of anything that would come to mind.
Or would you say that the media was pretty agreeable with the photos or the news stories that you worked with?
Not always.
Oh.
Yeah. There were certain events that took place that I thought were very much up front and explained to them that got skewed several days later in the interpretation.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the inquiry that happened out of that and so on. And sometimes the really positive side of it got overshadowed by a couple incidents that took place.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, you know, I can visualize in my head that we were out doing a patrol and we stopped and were helping this little village. Their water system wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
So the guys were trying to fix the well pump.
Right.
And this local come walking up and the medic that was with us, you know, set him down on the end of the armored vehicle we were on and, you know, started administering first aid to his leg and stuff that was festered and,
mm-hmm.
you know, cleaned up the wound and bandaged him up and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. And that was just one of all kinds of incidents that happened.
Mm-hmm.
But they did that type of stuff.
Yeah.
And, of course, a lot of that was overshadowed by
mm-hmm.
the other events that took place.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the exception, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other, my other experiences were
right.
all sort of positive.
Okay. Do you think that there's enough Canadian literature for civilians to understand or appreciate the role of public affairs in the Canadian military?
Oh, probably not. I would be hard-pressed to find some myself, I
mm-hmm.
think. So, yeah, just based on that, I would say probably not.
Mm-hmm.
Unless somebody that was, you know, interest in public affairs within the military as a career,
mm-hmm.
where they would actually research it to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I don't think there's a lot of general
mm-hmm.
Knowledge about what public affairs does for the military or in the military.
Do you think that Canadians would benefit more if they had more research done on public affairs?
Probably, you know, knowledge is always good.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Information is good. So, yeah, I don't see how it couldn't help.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, some authors have portrayed, I think you touched this on this mm-hmm. a bit, but some authors have portrayed the relationship between the military and the media as primarily oppositional, while others have emphasized cooperation between the two. Would you characterize the relationship between the military and the media as cooperational or as oppositional?
I would say probably the vast majority are cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Especially in Victoria. It's a, they used to call it military town.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the media outlets in this town are very positive.
Mm-hmm.
Nationally, there's a couple of, outfits that, are a bit confrontational. But maybe sometimes you need that sort of watchdog mentality,
mm-hmm.
to keep everybody in line,
mm-hmm.
or a check to make sure that things are all above board and stuff.
Yeah.
But I think the vast majority of media outlets are, cooperative.
Yeah.
And the military's cooperation is the word for the day, I think.
Yeah. How do you say the importance of security impacted your work? Does that make sense?
Oh, okay. Well, at one time, it wasn't as big a
mm-hmm.
deal. Because it took so long for information to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, as they say, OPSEC, operational security, is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Because even like the names of people
mm-hmm.
who are on taskings, assignments, deployments, that can be researched and spread out to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, the fact that, people were deployed in a certain area and everybody knew who they were,
mm-hmm.
but the information never got out to the wrong side,
mm-hmm.
where now it's out there almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot more it's a lot more important now, operational security, than it was back in, way back. My very first tour in Cyprus, which was in 1975. So back then it took, 6 weeks to get a letter back and forth.
Yeah.
Whereas now it takes, less than 6 minutes
mm-hmm.
to get the same information across half the world.
Were there any steps that you had to take to ensure security that you're allowed to share?
Yeah, once again, back when everything was done by pen and paper, by the time the information got back home, it was history.
Mm.
So it wasn't as critical. Now, of course, when I was in Bosnia, and I would call my wife and I would say, I won't be able to talk to you for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the end of that part of the conversation.
Right.
She wouldn't ask why or anything like that, because she, and I really couldn't tell her where I was going or what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that part is very, very prevalent today,
mm-hmm.
whereas we know the ships are going somewhere. You can't hide where they are because there's this big gray thing on the water.
Yeah.
But they just restrict that information.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like I said, it's far more important now than mm-hmm. it ever was in the past.
Right.
Going back to the veterans from Dieppe, where they would, it would take months for a letter Mm-hmm. You know, by the time you sent your letter off and got a response to that letter, you almost had to remember what you wrote originally.
Yeah.
You have to make a duplicate. So you can remember when you get the answer to whatever question it was, well, what did I ask? But now, of course, they communicate from the ships or anywhere in the world, instantaneous. So any information you put out there potentially could be intercepted or mm-hmm. used by somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did your relationship with the media ever cause any difficulties with other Canadian Force members? Or were they mostly cooperative?
At times, because of our relationship with the media, mm-hmm. Certain members would view you as being not black or white, but sort of gray.
Mm.
So they wouldn't be as open to you. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem, too, is whether you're a public affairs team, as they used to call it, where you have a public affairs officer and a photographer, and they would basically parachute you into a group of people, a regiment or a ship's company or something like mm-hmm. that. And it always took time to be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during that time when you were sort of gray,
right.
Especially if you came in with a group of media at the same time. They would paint you with the same brush until they got to know you a little bit. Or, you know, it was always good if you knew somebody within that particular unit already.
Yeah.
Then they would say, oh, yeah, that's it. He's okay. He's a good guy. You know, and they would open up a bit more. But there was always that reluctance
right.
until you became part of their family.
Yeah.
And then once you became part of their family, then they would open up more.
Mm-hmm.
Even if more media came in, it would be, you know, it became less gray.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Have you worked with photography since retiring from the Canadian Forces?
Well, since retiring, taking the uniform off, I'm now employed as a civilian photographer
uh-huh.
for DND.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I don't wear the uniform anymore, I'm still part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
So, but outside of that, it used to be my passion, and I would do it at work, and I would do it at home.
Mm-hmm.
I would do it as part of as a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten away from it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that once I retire, I will pick up my camera once again and go do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot easier now to mm-hmm. do it as a hobby
mm-hmm.
because the cost to do it now is a lot less
mm-hmm.
because you're not buying film, you're not processing, you're not printing.
Mm-hmm.
You're just putting it on a memory card that you can reuse and reuse and reuse.
Yeah.
All you need is, of course, a laptop or a computer
mm-hmm.
to process your imagery. But the cost of it as a hobby now is, you know, a fraction of what mm-hmm. it was once then.
For sure.
Yeah. But, no, I wandered off in other areas as far as my passions go.
Yeah.
But that's such is life.
Mm-hmm, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you would like to share about your experience as a photographer?
Oh, I've been quoted as saying, this is a little article they produced and put in the Lookout, the base paper here in Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
To me, a military photographer is probably the best occupation, best trade in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been quoted as saying that it's like going to Baskin and Robbins and sampling every flavor of ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been very fortunate. I've worked with the Army, I've worked with the Air Force, I've worked with the Navy. I've sailed on ships, I've, you know, flown in jet aircraft, I've sailed on submarines, I've lived in the dirt with the Army, and I feel that I've experienced virtually everything that is out there that the military does.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very few, if any, trades other than photographer that I feel that has that opportunity. Not everybody gets to do it, of course,
mm-hmm.
but the opportunity may exist to experience everything the military has to offer,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I'm passionate about the trade
mm-hmm.
and the occupation. It's Yeah, like I say, I think it's the best one there is. I might have a slanted opinion on here, but that's my opinion.
Justified. So, this concludes the military oral history program interview with retired Sergeant Ed Dixon. So, I would like to give you the interview release form. If you could sign it, that would be great. Terrific. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Dixon, thank you for this interview.
You're quite welcome.